Hey, everybody, just a quick word before we get started with this week's episode. What better gift to get the Air Raid fan in your life but two t-shirts and a poster from the Air Raid podcast? That's right. Go to air-raid.net, follow the instructions on the merch tab, and purchase a couple for your lover or your friend. It's a great gift. Also, you can donate to the show, $5, $10, whatever, $100, $100 million, to help us out, get some more equipment that we need here in Dining Room Studios. All right, happy holidays, everybody. Enjoy. Well, hello and welcome, everyone.
We're going to get this place hot and clammy.
Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast.
I'm not bumping your fist.
This is episode 126.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
In what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series.
Seems like someone definitely touched my drum set.
I am your host, Aaron Roden.
He once had an awkward moment just to see how it feels.
And this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. And boy, do we have a veritable payload of awesome for you this week. Oh, man. Oh, man. You guys are going to enjoy the living crap out of this episode. I swear to you. I swear to you. It's a lot of good stuff. We're going to be talking with this guy, D. Simon, fellow podcaster of the Sick and Wrong podcast, and also author of this new book called Play Something Dancy, which is now available on Amazon.com. Just go ahead and type that into a search there. Play Something Dancy. Oh, man. And it's good. It's good. The Tragic Tales of a Strip Club DJ. And, somewhat of a memoir of his life, talking about drug abuse, what it was like working in the strip club scene in San Francisco. Very good book. I highly recommend it, although it is for adult eyes, definitely, for obvious reasons, right? I mean, anything about a strip club is going to have some sort of sexual connotations to it, I would imagine. Anyway, he's going to be joining us here shortly. Okay, here's a story for you. Got this email from D a couple months ago. Well, maybe just about a month ago. And he reached out to us here at the Air Raid Podcast, which you can do as well. Just send me an email, aaron@air-raid.net, and maybe we can correspond about something, whatever's on your mind. You know, I'm here for you. That's kind of. Unless it's like super, super serious, like a huge issue with like mental illness or something. I don't know if I can really help you there, because I've got my own. I've got my own issues, guys. Anyway, so D contacted me about a month ago, sent me his book, and wanted to talk about it. And so, you know, when you get these emails, sometimes you gotta vet people sometimes, right? But anyway, I started reading this book, and it was a lot of fun. It's a very fun read. A collection of short stories about just what he was experiencing back in kind of the mid '90s, early '90s, up into the 2000s, and an interesting life. About, like I said before, drug abuse and strippers. But it got me thinking, right, about my own strip club experience. And, it's not something that I'm proud of to say, you know, yes, I've been to a strip club. I think a majority of men out there my age can probably say that. I've only been to two in my whole life. And it does, I mean, it makes you feel a little dirty. You definitely, you get in there. You have these, I don't know, the media, the movies, things like that make strip clubs seem, there's some like mystique around them, you know. But really, once you walk into these places, it just stinks of men, and it's just gross. So my first experience with a strip club. Let's go back. Go back all the way to 1997. Or was it 1998? I can't remember how old you have to be to actually enter a strip club. I think it's 18. But anyway, it was my friend Colin's birthday. He was turning 18 years old. I was already 18. My buddy Chance was already 18. And so we decided to take Colin out to a strip club. And we were going to go to this. The plan was is that we were going to go into Bremerton over there on the Kitsap Peninsula here in Washington. And take him to this place called the Deja Vu, which I believe is kind of, it's like, I don't know, it's like the McDonald's of strip clubs, right? It's definitely a chain. Simon talks about it in his book, Play Something Dancy, which we'll talk to him about in just a moment. And, you know, it's a chain. So anyway, we didn't know how to get there, but we did all know about this little place called Toys Topless there in Gorst. In Gorst. I said that right. There is a town called Gorst, and they did have this tiny little hole-in-the-wall strip club called Toys Topless that was underneath the highway, the highway on-ramp. And it was just like, I mean, it was painted bright green at one point. I mean, you couldn't miss this thing if you, you know, were driving past it. And there was always, you know, I always thought about it. Like, what the hell does that place look like on the inside? Well, since we didn't know how to get to the Deja Vu, we decided to go to Toys Topless. Now, it was talked about that we were not going to tell anyone that we went to Toys Topless. We were going to tell everybody that we went to Deja Vu because that was supposed to be kind of the upscale, cool place, right? Now, I was very nervous. I had never been to a strip club. At that point in my life, it was an extreme possibility that I had never even seen a naked woman in real life yet. But so we go to this place and we walk through the door and my fears are manifested in just a stench of BO and, you know, male excretions for lack of a better term. And it was just disgusting. I mean, the place was just so run down. It felt like it could, the building could collapse as soon as we walked through the front door. We come inside, and there's only about three or four other guys. They're all old, grizzly dudes wearing Carhartt jackets and drinking soda pop. Because in the state of Washington, you're not allowed to drink liquor or beer in strip clubs. I think that's the same for many places. And of course, the DJ is pumping some sort of, you know, Led Zeppelin or AC/DC, and there is a naked woman on the stage. Now, the naked woman was, of the rotund variety, not that there's anything wrong with that, of course, but, you know, it's not something that you would expect to see at your first strip club, right? You're in a young man's mind, what you're thinking about when you walk through the doors of an establishment such as this is that every woman up on stage is going to be drop-dead gorgeous, and they're going to be into you, right? That's the thought. That's the thought behind this, except you're paying for it, right? Anyway, so we sit down, and we get a couple soda pops from the waitress, and another woman comes and sits down next to us and starts asking us if we would like to pay for a lap dance. Now, keep in mind, we are 18 years old. Our friend Colin had just turned 18. I was probably 18 for like maybe 4 months, and it was just the most awkward thing in the world. Now, you weren't supposed to deal in cash, so they gave you these little chips that you had to like throw out onto the stage for tips and stuff, and you weren't allowed to touch anybody or anything like that, of course. But this woman that sat down next to us was missing about three or four teeth, I remember, and she was taking a liking to Chance, my friend Chance, and she just sat down right next to him and kind of, you know, scooched her chair forward and got in real close and just sat there in silence. And what are we supposed to do? We're watching these women that are definitely down on their luck dance up on this stage, and it just was the most shameful thing I think I've ever done in my whole life. I've never felt more dirty. It was terrible. I walked into the bathroom at one point and could hear a man... you know, giving himself the treatment in the stall next to me. I mean, it was horrible. It was horrifying. Horrifying. So there's my, that's my first ever strip club experience. You'll be happy to know that the second one, I was drunk when I went there, and I don't remember much of it. So there you go. Oh, and by the way, we never got the lap dance from the toothless toothless stripper. But yeah. So is that a good story? That's not even a really good story. It didn't even go anywhere, did it? Terrible. I think I'm getting worse at telling stories as time goes on. It's horrifying. Anyway, let's get to this conversation with D, shall we? D. Simon. Excellent book, Play Something Dancey. We're going to be featuring music today by none other than Eric Blood, who we had on the show a couple months ago. So go to the archives page and check that out. This is off of his new album, Touch Screens. And this is the song Phenomenal Pornography. How fitting, right? Totally. See, some things are thought through on this show. All right, we'll be right back. Stay with us. All right, welcome back, everybody. That was Phenomenal Pornography off of the most recent album by Eric Blood called Touch Screens. And joining me here in Dining Room Studios, well, not actually here, but on the line, is Mr. D. Simon, author.
Hey, what's up?
How's it going, man?
Not too bad. Didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, you did. You meant to, and you did it, and you did
right.
It well.
Yeah. I did.
No, author of the all new book, Play Something Dancey, The Tragic Tales of a Strip Club DJ. Well, first off, welcome to the show. And second, holy crap.
Well, thanks for having me, Aaron.
Yeah. I've been reading the book that you sent me. In PDF format because here's what I did. So I hate reading things on electronic equipment. So I went ahead and just printed this whole thing out.
Wow.
At my work.
I could have sent you a PDF.
At my work. I printed it out at my work. So don't worry. I didn't pay for any paper or printer ink. But, so
you're
I've been carrying, yeah, exactly. I've been carrying around this giant, you know, thing of printer paper here. You might be able to hear it here. I'm flipping through it right now.
I'll take your word for it, but
yeah,
it sounds large.
But so I've been reading it. I've only gotten about halfway through the book, but I've got to say it's definitely reeled me in, and I find it very it's very entertaining, sir.
Oh, cool! Thanks.
Yeah, yeah. So what kind of prompted you to think about starting this this project?
This opus. Well, part of it was actually to validate the five horrific years I spent in that industry.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it wasn't all just it wasn't all tragic. Obviously, I'm exaggerating about it, but you know, it was kind of regrettable. It's like, you know, while my friends are sitting here pursuing, you know, law school or in grad school for something actually admirable, you know, here I am you know, hawking sluts at the local food bungalow. And so, you know, during that time, I was just, you know, during that time, I wanted to write a book. And so I was assiduously taking notes on everything and all the funny stuff and all the funny shit that happened. There's a lot of funny shit happened, especially when you work at those clubs.
I can imagine. Strippers.
Yeah, a lot of strippers do too. But then, you know, the initial idea is I was writing a work of fiction.
Uh-huh.
I wrote a good 200 pages, and then there's a lot of people do. You just eventually you look back at it, people shouldn't do this actually. But you look back at it, you start second guessing yourself. You're like, this sucks.
Uh-huh.
And so I just stopped and I just kind of shelved it. And then
when did you start this then?
Oh, this was 3 years ago.
Oh, really? Okay. Okay.
Yeah, maybe 3.5 years ago. It was a while ago. And I worked. I think I quit the strip club thing in 2007, 2006 maybe.
Okay.
And then a couple years later, I started writing this book, and it was this magnificent work of fiction, you know, American novel kind of thing. And then I stopped and took a look at it, and I was like, oh, this just sucks. And I just shelved it and didn't do anything. And you know, people should do that. You should, you know, take it up and look at it again and maybe look at it from a different angle or perspective, because you probably do have something worthwhile there.
Right.
But
and I wanted to bring this up too, because you brought up a curious point that I would like to talk to you about. In the author's note at the beginning of the book, it states, and I quote, "This book is a collection of short stories that occurred during a 5-year period of my life. Regrettably, the events of this book are real. However, in order to protect myself from criminal prosecution, civil liability, names, locations, and identifying characteristics had to be changed. The dialogue and events have been recreated solely from memory, and I've smoked a lot of drugs since these events occurred. With that in mind, some of the dialogue and certain events may have been altered, combined, and even fabricated at times to convey the substance of what was said or what occurred." Because I read the first story. Maybe we should explain this. The book is Play Something Dancy, The Tragic Tales of a Strip Club DJ, and it basically takes place over the whole period of time that you worked as a strip club DJ, correct?
Yes, it's not chronological, but yeah.
Right. It jumps around.
I did it where I took stories from I worked in a strip club, I think it was a little over 5 years, and took a bunch of different stories.
Right.
And I told them, so they're not... Well, in the beginning, it's kind of chronological, but the rest of the book isn't supposed to be.
Right. And so, like you said, it's a bunch of short stories from your time as a strip club DJ. And so, as I read the first story, the story entitled Lexi, the opening story to this magnificent book, it's very vivid. It's of a graphic nature. So for adults only, adult readers only, of course. But it was very graphic. It was well written, and it was definitely entertaining. But I was thinking as I'm reading through this, I was no effing way, this is happening. And then I read this disclaimer, and I was okay, this makes more sense now. We're dealing with a drug addict who at times may remember things wrong, and you spell that out in the author's note. And I thought that was commendable, because, you know, as memoirs, A Million Little Pieces, right?
I think that's why a lot of authors started using these authors, you know, in the beginning. I mean, you read Tucker Mack, David Sedaris does the same. I pretty much kind of took a lot of mine from David Sedaris.
Uh-huh.
But the fact of the matter is, actually, in Lexi, those events did occur. I did use a hammer with a girl. It wasn't my instigation. It was her.
Right, right. Yeah, doing, yeah, yeah.
You know,
let's be clear on that.
Okay, it's just a brief synopsis to people who haven't read the story. I'm already damning it. People are like, this just sounds disgusting. It's like,
Yeah.
Okay, what would happen in it is, it was a funny story. It was like, I woke up, and this is actually kind of common. When you work at a strip club, it's really easy to get laid. It was way easier than college ever was. Because these girls, well, first of all, have emotional issues. But also, it's like no one wants to date them because they're damaged. And they work at these strip clubs. So if you work at a strip club, you become really good friends with them. And it's seriously, all it was like, hey, what are you doing at work? And come over, smoke some weed. Next thing you know, you're having sex.
Right.
And some of them are crazy, crazy, insane women. And this girl, Lexi, was one of those women. She was older and definitely did porn, like, way back in the day. She was really hot, like, in 1992.
Yeah.
But then I was a little older, a little worn out. I'd say almost haggard would be a good adjective.
Uh-huh.
When I had sex with her, and I remember I did not please her. Even though I tried, I didn't. I don't think Ron Jeremy could have pleased this woman. And so she suggested that we use a hammer to please her.
Right.
And I remember being completely shocked, and she's like, literally, I remember as clear as day her going, and I didn't, this was not fabricated. Put a condom on it, stupid. Because I was like holding this hammer, like, what do you want me to do with this? And it's unbelievable some of the events of these stories. Yeah,
there's
outrageous that happened there.
But how much stuff would you say is like, you know, a little bit, and I don't, you know,
creative.
It's a little bit. You're using artistic creativity, right?
Artistic life. You know, part of the things that I did with it is, a lot of the dialogue was
kind of
strung together based on memory. I mean, it's almost, it's a lot of these events occurred like, you know, 6-7 years ago. So, yeah, like to make a cohesive narrative, I did have to string together like some dialogue and to just commit a context of the actual story itself.
Right.
But the events and like the subject of it all, these are all like real stories. And like, I mean, you read like a story like the Red Light Special, that shit goes on in strip clubs. You have to do these horrible dance specials. I'm not making this shit up.
Right.
It was bad.
Yeah.
But then like, I think I go into, I don't know if you got to this far, but one of the stories is Dove the Retard, and strippers that have written memoirs themselves.
Yeah.
Like Diablo Cody wrote a book about being like a stripper. It's got a memoir, so sort of similar to what I did. And but she has a completely different perspective on customers. I'm not giving lap dances to them. You know, I'm just seeing them and just, you know, as an outside observer, I'm definitely have no contact with them.
Well, yeah, you're experiencing this whole thing as like a third person view, right? A third person point of view.
I used to think it was like an omniscient observer because usually the DJ is upstairs. You don't even see it. It's like a disembodied voice.
Yeah.
You're just kind of touched the scene and looking down on everyone, you know, but they don't have any contact with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? You're
the silent judge.
Yeah. You know. At one point, I don't know if, they have a lot of, you guys are up in Seattle, right?
Right, yeah.
I remember going to Portland about a year ago for a bachelor party, and they were like, God, there's the most strip clubs per capita of any city is in Portland.
I've actually heard that before. Yeah, yeah. There's a ton of them down there.
Yeah, there's just a lot of them. But so in San Francisco, and this was part of the reason why a lot of things in the book did have to be changed. So San Francisco, there are a lot of strip clubs, but they're all owned by this same ruthless company managed.
Yeah.
And so they make you sign this kind of a confidentiality agreement. So that's why, like, I remember initially I wrote this story. I was done, like, back in February. And I was going to publish it, and then someone was like, you know, maybe you should go meet with a lawyer and just find out if, you know, what could possibly happen if someone, you know, read something and, you know, I'm not very kind to a lot of people, like managers that work at those clubs.
Right.
And initially I didn't even change any names or anything. And so I take it to this lawyer, and this lawyer's like, she was like, you know, you need to change every identifying feature and every name, because if anybody can recognize themselves in this text, they will sue you.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was like, wow. Okay, so it took a lot of reworking, and that's where some of the, you know, that's why I was saying, like, you know, some of the things have been fabricated, because I did have to change, like, okay, this guy was actually black, but now he's Puerto Rican.
Right, right, yeah, 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 totally, totally.
So that kind of stuff, but, you know, I think that's very common when people write these memoir-type books, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, when the whole thing with James Frey went down with A Million Little Pieces, I was just like, because he kind of said the same thing, you know, a lot of the stories were based on truth. However, there was like things that he kind of came up with to either make the story juicier or fill in the blanks, right?
And like, he never went to jail.
No, he did. I don't think he went to jail. No,
but he said he did in the story that he spent like a week.
Right. Yeah, he told. I mean, like I said, some of the stuff was at, like outright fabrications to kind of make the story more interesting.
I mean, you could validate that, you know, I mean, you could go look in San Francisco and find out, like, all the different clubs that I worked at.
Right, right.
Probably, I would say a lot of these people still work at some of these clubs, which is even more tragic.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, I want to get into that in just a second. But I did want to talk to you a little bit about the second story in the book is about how you first, like, went to your first strip club. As a kid,
oh,
right?
Okay.
As a teenager?
Yeah, I think I call that one Frustration McLonely.
Oh, that's the third story in there.
Oh, that's the third? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. But this one was by far my favorite so far. Because it really outlines what goes on in a teenager's mind, a teenage boy's mind about, you know, the female form, right? And how I'm sorry.
When you first saw your first naked woman.
Yeah, 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 exactly. And how, and like to what lengths, you know, because nowadays everybody's got the internet and you can get porn is readily available for anybody who wants to see it. All you have to say is like, yes, of course I'm 18. And then all, you know, the world is opened up to you, for lack of a better term. But, you know, as a teenage boy back in either, you know, the 80s, early 90s, you had to really search and come up with very creative ways to get your eyes on a naked lady's body.
You know, I mean, that's the one thing. It's like I feel like a lot of kids today don't understand how good they have it. I mean, they really do. It's like they can go on to these amazing tube sites that just have videos of porn, copious videos of porn, any kind of porn that they want.
And they don't sit through the story anymore. It's just the sex scene.
It's just the scene. You don't have to like even worry about like, I mean, these kids today never have to experience going to like a video store in a trench coat and getting like a shitty video from the back, you know, and in like a brown paper bag and then going home and putting it in the VCR and hoping it doesn't get stuck.
Right.
And your parents' VCR, you know, I mean, we had to do all that stuff back in the day.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Even, do you remember this? Like, a lot of kids had the older brother that you'd steal porn from, or you'd find the shitty porn in the woods.
Yes. Okay. This is a thing, and this is something that we've talked about many times on this show, is that it's always in the woods. There's always porn in the woods somewhere, right? No matter where you grow up. Like, you could grow up in a city, it would be in, it'd be in a park, you know, or it'd be in a dumpster somewhere. I don't understand why.
Like a leprechaun's pot of gold. You know what I mean? Like, we were kids, I grew up in Michigan, like outside of Detroit. And like, I remember the first time I ever really saw porn was, we found a box in the woods. It was just filled with some hustlers. And I was like, and they're kind of like already kind of weathered from, you know, just being rained on a few times.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I treasured that thing. I took one, my friend took one, my other friend took one, and we treasured that thing. I think
Yeah.
I mean, I used it till it deteriorated into nothing.
Yeah, I've told this story many times, so I won't go too far into it, but we found some in an abandoned house that just got ripped apart. I grew up in a small town over on the Kitsap Peninsula here in Washington. And it just got ravaged by every boy in the town, And so it was just strewn everywhere. And we had to come up with like creative ways to like dry the pages out. Some people put them in microwaves. Some people put them in like a dryer, something like that. But this other time we found a cache of stolen like Sega Genesis games and Super Nintendo games stashed in the woods. And it had one videotape. Everything had been looted. There was just like the cartridge covers, you know, for all the games and stuff, except for this one videotape. And it turned out to be the most insane porno video that I'd ever seen in my life. And even to this day, like I think back on that with, you know, fond memories, because it got passed around the whole elementary school, made it to the junior high in a neighboring town, and just got passed around there, and then was just lost in a sea of children's hands. You know, but it is, it's a strange thing. Like who, you know, this one was obviously stolen from somewhere, but who in their right mind goes and is like, you know what, we're just going to give this back to the earth. We're going to take this box of porno and just stick it somewhere on a trail for somebody else. I guess it is. It's kind of a cool thing to do. It's like somebody else can use this now.
You know, I remember when I moved in with my first time I ever lived with a serious girlfriend in Chicago. I lived in Chicago. We moved in together, and I remember like I was leaving my studio apartment, and I was just like, and I had like a, you know, back then, I mean, even because it was the 90s, so I don't even think we, you know, porn, you still had to download, like, you had a dial up connection, so
oh,
porn
yeah,
wasn't that
yeah.
big online. And so I had a bunch of magazines and videos, and I was like, it's a shame to throw these away because there's kids out there that can really just benefit from this. So I remember taking them and like going off in the woods, like driving, and then just putting them out there and being like, I hope a kid finds this.
Shut
and,
up. You're one of those guys.
Yeah, totally. I did it on purpose
because
I felt it was just a waste to dump it in a dumpster.
Oh,
and
man.
I knew if my girlfriend found it, she was going to be horrified, and I didn't even want to have to talk about why I'm into that.
Yeah, totally, totally. Well, let's say, hey, D, let's switch gears. I want to get back to kind of your life as a strip club DJ really quick. And you don't have to, you know, we want people to buy the book, so you don't have to reveal too much of what's in these stories. But how did you, can you relay a little bit of how you got started in as a strip club DJ?
Yeah, you know, I think I talked about that in, like, it's either the second or third, I think it's the third story, maybe.
Right, right.
Where I talk about, like, my entrance into the strip club world. And so what happened, briefly, I moved to San Francisco in, like, right during that huge dot-com, like, craziness.
Uh-huh.
And that was, like, the early 2000s. And back then, it was so easy to get a job. Like, I got this job doing graphic design, making a shitload of money. And it was awesome, because everybody in San Francisco just made a lot of money and was really doing nothing. I didn't even know what we were doing. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't even, my company didn't even have a product. It was just like this online company that lots of sponsored money. And then all of a sudden, all that money disappeared. And then maybe it was six weeks later, it was just like, everybody's gone. No severance. You're done.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how it happened. And, you know, that was the fate of a lot of those, you know, fledgling.com companies in San Francisco. And so then all of a sudden, you know, the whole town of is filled with graphic designers who are unemployed.
Right,
I couldn't get a job. Like, I tried doing, you know, even I've worked at Kinko's for a little bit and just tried anything I could to get a job. I think I was unemployed for about 8 months, 9 months.
Yeah. How old are you at this point?
Let's see. That was 2001.
Okay.
So, God, I must have been like 24, I think. Yeah, 25 maybe.
Oh, okay. So you're still, you know, you're young.
Yeah, I'm kind of young, you know, mid-20s. And so then I had this drug dealer who's my pot dealer, and he's a cool guy, and he also DJed at one of the clubs on Broadway in San Francisco, and he was like, dude, you do a radio show. And back then I did a heavy metal radio show called Rampage Radio for KUSF, which is a great non-commercial local station.
Cool,
KUSF 90.3 FM. I think they went under, but I think they're just online now. But I did this heavy metal show for them for years. And he was like, you know, you do radio, you could easily, you know, spit some strip club lines. And so he set me up with an audition, and I went to truly just an awful club. I don't even want to say it. I think I called it the Dollhouse.
Yeah.
It was a horrible club, but it's not it has a different name.
Yeah.
It's on Broadway. Anyway, I went there and sure enough, like, it actually came really natural for me. Like, I remember being really nervous, like even more nervous than I was for, you know, a job interview for like a $70,000 a year job.
Right.
You know?
Well, there's a part in this story too, where you're talking about how nervous you are getting up there, and the guy that's showing you kind of the quick, you know, run through of the equipment and stuff, he just hands you the mic all of a sudden and you've got to go.
Yeah.
But there's only like a stripper and one just sick, gross pervert sitting there. And that rang true to me because I used to play in a band, and like that was the most nerve wracking thing, was to play for like two people in an empty bar.
You know,
right?
There's nothing sadder than a strip club on like a Tuesday at 1 p.m. You know, it's so sad. It's just like the girls working there are sad.
Yeah.
The two Mexican dudes just sitting there drinking soda.
Right, right.
You know, they're longingly that want nothing to do with them. Like, it's just sad, the whole scene. And so, yeah, there's just like this one old pervert just sitting there. And I think we had two girls that were working, but yeah, I was so nervous.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Total butterflies. And then when I was doing it, it was totally natural. Like, yeah. It was just like, you know, gentlemen, put those hands together. Candy.
Well, you definitely, now that I'm talking to you, like I can put a voice to the words on the page, and it you know, you sound good. Yeah, you should have never left.
You know, it was funny because I don't even think I wrote about this, but I went through, I kind of picked up like a lot of DJs. I do mention it a little bit where you talk about the DJ line. You know, they tell you to go hang out at different clubs and listen to the other DJs, and then you sort of get your style together. And what happened to me is I had a mentor, this one dude. He was like my Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
And his name was Gio. I didn't talk about him, but yeah, dude, crazy cokehead. But this guy was so good. He was so funny, just effortless. Everything he said was funny.
Yeah,
and he had a
yeah.
great, like, really deep, smooth voice, but he had a horrible coke problem. And he was completely unreliable. Like, he'd just not show up for shift and be gone for like 2 weeks.
Oh, man.
But this is when I worked at the really fancy club, because I did my time at like all these different clubs there. But the one club I ultimately worked at for like 3 years, I was making like, you know, you make like $1,500 on a Friday night.
Wow.
Yeah.
So part of the tips go to you guys then, or what? How does that work?
Yeah, the way it works is every girl usually, especially if they like you, they tip you like at least $20 a piece, sometimes more.
Oh, dang.
If do favors, you know, like, because sometimes these girls would want to be skipped, or, you know, you hook them up with something that they a little pick me up. It's like you'll get extra money. So there are some nights, like on a Friday night, I'd walk with like $1,500 in cash.
Yeah, yeah.
And this guy that mentored me, just like he'd disappear, you know, you wouldn't see him, then he'd end up in a rehab. So eventually I got his shifts.
Uh-huh.
And so I became like the main DJ at this club. I call it the Ruby Club in the book.
I can't wait to get to that part.
Yeah, it's a little later.
This sounds really interesting. Yeah, yeah. Well, hey, let's do this, D. Let's take a you can stick around a little bit longer, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, wonderful. We're gonna go to our second musical break here. We're featuring music by Eric Blood off of the album Touch Screens, which D, you should definitely check out because it is a full album, a concept album about 70s and. Or 60s and 70s porno movies.
Oh, wow,
so
cool.
It has
that kind of that same kind of like guitar tone, like a bounce, that kind of thing.
Not quite.
Oh.
Yeah, you'll have to check it out. This is the song Amputee by Eric Blood off of his album Touchscreens, and we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Stay with us.
We'll be right back.
I've had some people that have emailed that have just like had done some really cool books. Like this guy wrote a book that he, you should have him on if you ever get a chance.
What's his name?
The History of Poop.
The History of Poop? I think I've heard of that book before.
Oh, he's really cool too. He emailed me and sent me like his press release and everything, and I was reading it. And I'm like, God, dude, this book is great. I mean, it was interesting. It was like the history of toilet paper, toilets, everything about poop, which is, I mean, it's gross, but I mean, it's actually kind of fascinating.
Well, it's like the ultimate. That's the ultimate like toilet reader, right?
That's kind of what that dude said. He's
like,
oh, it's a great book to leave on your shitter, you know?
Yeah, like, totally. Well, hey, welcome back, everybody. That song was Amputee by Eric Blood off of his all-new album, Touchscreens. And actually, you can hear our interview with Eric Blood a little while back. I can't remember what episode that was in, but go and check it out. Go to the archives page at our website, www.air-raid.net. And just click on the archives tab and all the shows are there. Welcome back, D. Snyder, author of the book Play Something Dancy, The Tragic Tales of a Strip Club DJ. And before we left,
Hold on one second. You said D. Snyder, which is actually not my name. It's D. Snyder. D. Snyder is one of my idols. The lead singer of Twisted Sister, one of my idols. So I'm actually very impressed that you said that.
Oh, good. Sorry about that, D. D. Simon. I think I actually mixed that up too when I told somebody that I was reading this book. Yeah, I was like, it's by D. Snyder.
This is my favorite band throughout the 80s.
Yeah. They were pretty good. Hey, but so during the break there we were talking a little bit. You have your own podcast as well called the Sick and Wrong Podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. We're like one of the old school podcasts. Like it's funny. I was on another show. I don't know if you heard of the Mediocre Show, but
yeah.
They've been around a little longer than us. I think we're on our 58th episode. And
wait,
like
say that again. You cut out just a little bit there.
Like we just released our episode 358.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and these guys, the Mediocre Show, did like 362 or something, and so we're chatting, and they're like, yeah, we're kind of like the old guard of podcasts before like every comedian got their own. You know, like now it's like every comedian has a podcast.
Right. Yeah.
But and there's some like old ones, like Distorted View, Keith and the Girl, there's a few others too. But yeah, like Sick and Wrong has been around since 2006.
Wow, man.
Going strong.
And that's the tell right there about a show that has, you know, quote unquote staying power. Really is because people don't give up after about 25 episodes, right? I think if you make it over like 100 episodes, which we just did like 26 episodes ago, I guess. You know, it's a real thing, right?
You know, I was about to say the milestone is 100 episodes. When you've made it past 100,
yeah,
then you're gonna last, and then 200, 300, you know, just kind of come. But the main thing with podcasts, and this is when a lot of podcasts just kind of fade away, is it's you have to be consistent. You have to release one once a week.
Yes.
And if you
did
once every 2 weeks, once every 3 weeks, you know, you lose your audience. So that's kind of what Sick and Wrong's never actually missed a week.
Good for you guys.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
Every show is amazing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The show is pretty good.
yeah, it's hard to do sometimes. What we were talking about, because you emailed me about your book, and when you get these emails, because you've gone through the same thing, and that's what we were talking about when we came back from the break, is that sometimes it can be a real crapshoot, you know, and you sent me the manuscript to the show, and already, I mean, my interest was piqued. I mean, you put strip club in the title of a book, and I'm going to read it.
Yeah, you never know when you get these, like, blind emails. And, I mean, some of them, like, some of them we never really go through with, but we get a lot of them. But I remember, like, the funniest ones that I got was the guy sent me an email, this was a long time ago, about a couple of years ago. He wrote a memoir about having sex with a dolphin. Do you hear about this guy?
Oh, my God, no. What?
Yeah, The Wet Goddess. The Wet Goddess is the name of the book. And people, actually, I highly recommend, if you're going to get a stocking stuffer for people, get Play Something Nancy and The Wet Goddess.
And The Wet Goddess.
And the relatives will never speak to you again. Like, if you don't want us to hang out with your mother-in-law, just get those two books. You're set.
I'm gonna get your book and that one for my grandma.
Yeah. It was funny. He emailed this. He emailed me with like a really shitty press release.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was a synopsis of the first two chapters.
Yeah.
And I read it and I was like, holy shit, this guy fucked a dolphin.
and he wrote a whole book about it.
Yeah, a relationship that he had a year.
Oh,
with a dolphin. I interviewed him and it was a really weird dude. It was an interesting interview. And then seriously, maybe 6 months later, he was on Howard Stern.
Oh, whoa.
You know? Yeah, yeah. It was like internet. He posted it to Reddit. And then, it was like all over the place.
Oh, man.
But
man.
Just like kind of randomly emailed Dick and Wrong. Which I was right.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, you never know who's going to come out from the woodwork.
Well, it just shows that you got to actually check some of this stuff out. You know, because
yep.
Totally. Some of it, like this, your book is definitely worthwhile. So, hey, I want to get back to talking about you. One constant theme in your book so far. Because I haven't, like I said, I haven't finished it. But I will, I promise you, I will finish the book. but one constant through line is the drugs.
Oh yeah.
And, I wanted to get into this a little bit because I've had my own problems with those demons, in my past. And so I wanted to ask you because you were getting into some pretty heavy stuff there, man.
You know, back then, my drug of choice, and I mentioned it was crystal meth.
Right.
It was interesting too, because in San Francisco there's a bit of a dichotomy depending on the clubs that you worked at. Like the low end clubs, it was just all like marijuana, crystal meth. Every
right.
single girl pretty much did crystal meth there.
Yeah.
But then at
yeah.
the higher end clubs, the more upscale clubs, it was coke.
Uh-huh.
And the coke people like frowned upon the crystal meth people. You know, and you had to hide your crystal meth doing it. It was just weird that there was this, like, dichotomy between two just awful drugs.
Right,
you know?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, crystal meth, and for the right reasons, all the right reasons, has always been kind of viewed as, you know, a really dirty drug. You know, I had some friends that went down that path when I was in high school and just leaving for college, and thank God I left for college at that time because I think I would have gotten into that stuff, and I don't know if I ever would have come out of it. But you know, it's
hard to get off of it.
What's that?
It was very difficult to get off of that one.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine, man. I've seen people go through it. So what? I mean, was it getting into the strip club scene that kind of got you into that?
You know, actually, the reason I got into crystal meth pretty big is because I'd been doing this radio show for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and the radio show was from like 2 to 8 in the morning, so it just became this like late night party scene.
Right.
And when you're up all night, you know, it's pretty much the drug that keeps you up all night.
Yeah.
And so then I started doing it, but I wasn't doing it on a regular basis. I only did this radio show maybe once every 2 weeks, once every 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I started at the strip club, I was everywhere. Every single coworker was doing it. Every girl was doing it. And then it got to the point where it's like, you know, you're after work, you're partying, you're up till like 4 or 5 in the morning. It
yeah.
becomes a lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, you start doing the drug, keeps you awake, and you sleep for a few hours, but then you're exhausted. You got to go to work again. You got to be on. You got to be exciting. And so you do like one little bump of meth, and next thing you know, you're like, gentlemen, let's put those hands together, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Just like just all excited about it. And I would get really creative on meth, actually. I think I talk about that in one of the stories.
Oh, nice. Now, did you get to a point, I'm guessing you got to a point where you hit bottom, right?
Yeah, you know, I actually didn't go into this either, but I'm planning on writing a second volume of stories where I'm going to get into this. But
oh, okay.
One of the guy that actually initially got me into the whole thing in the beginning, the guy that was my marijuana dealer, a weed dealer, he actually ended up getting shot and killed. And that was kind of a point where it was my exit from the strip club scene.
Uh-huh.
And also then I was like, you know, I got to give this whole thing up. I got to give this up. I got to give the drugs up. I got to get out of that radio show. It was like everything just kind of, I sort of had like that, you know, that 180 shift, which I think everybody needs to do, where you stop hanging out with that group of people. And, you know, I mean, a lot of shit happened, and I didn't even go into too much detail of this either, but, like, I was, you know, it ruined my relationship with this girl that I was with for, like, 5 years.
Uh-huh.
You know, we were, like, you know, engaged, and then it just kind of just haywired.
And yeah, so, yeah.
You know, just everything kind of shifted, and so, yeah, you know, you get to that point where you really look inside yourself, have to re-examine your life, and a lot of people can't turn around. They can't get out of that hole.
Well, it just gets too deep, right?
Yeah. You know, and then you never know what might happen. Like, there's so many drug casualties in this world, mm-hmm. which is part of the reason why I say a lot of these stories are really tragic. And now that I look back at them, like when I was writing I was looking at my notes and I was revisiting these experiences and I was like, God, you know, everyone thinks it's this glamorous job and you're getting laid all the time with all these, like, sexy women. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're hanging out with a lot of just drug addicts. It's actually really sad.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how many times, because this is something that I would do in my life when I was surrounded, you know, in similar drug situations. I don't think I could ever say that I had a similar strip club experience, but you know, when you're surrounded by people like that, like there are certain points of my experience that I was just like, God, I just felt so fucking dirty. Like, you know, just like I couldn't get clean from what I was doing, you know? And it was such a hard thing because you'd go home, you'd take a shower, and then you'd come back and you'd, you know, try to do it again.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of why, you know, what led me to eventually quit. You know, I never actually went to rehab. I did go through, like, a pretty crazy withdrawal for
mm-hmm,
it
mm-hmm.
and did relapse a few times. But I eventually quit it, just doing it myself, weaning myself off of it. But it was part of that thing, that feeling psychologically, internally, where you're like, God, this is just filthy.
And right,
it was like maybe we'd been up all night. And it was like 9 a.m. and I was at this guy's house. His name was like Devil James. I don't even know who this guy was. He was just a friend of a friend. And he was like a meth cook.
Yeah.
And he had cooked up this like massive breakfast or just everything, like pancakes, eggs, sausages, just every kind of breakfast item you could have.
Yeah.
And no one eating because everyone was high off their fucking head on meth.
Yeah.
Just
so
no
it just did.
Any food.
Yeah. Everything
and
just went bad.
Everybody. And I'm standing there just like, what the fuck am I doing? You know, it's like one of those come to Jesus moments. You're just like, God,
yeah.
I need to take a shower and get out of this.
Oh, man.
You know?
Oh, man.
I had like 30 experiences. It finally moved me on, yeah.
Well, apparently you have enough for a second book.
Well, I can smile about it now, but at the time it was terrible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, does any story in particular when you were writing this memoir kind of like hit you pretty hard? Did it come back like a bag of bricks?
You know, I kind of like, you know, a lot of the book is more of a humorous take on it. Like,
yeah, definitely.
I didn't really write any of the real, like, some of the stories you could just take it as you want, but part of it was a lot of these experiences were kind of funny, even though at the time they're pretty traumatic. Like there's one story that was extensively with my first experience with BD, like when I got gonorrhea for the first
mm-hmm,
time,
mm-hmm.
which I don't know if you've ever had any venereal diseases, but it's a horrific, mortifying experience.
Yeah.
And I remember getting this and like, you know, as I mentioned earlier, that it was so easy to have sex in the strip club, and a lot of times, like, you're high and you're drunk, you don't always use protection, which
right,
you should.
Right.
Always use protection, people, always. But occasionally there might have been some slips, and yeah, you know, I slipped and I caught gonorrhea. And I remember freaking out about it, and I call up my brother, like, works at a leather bar in San Francisco. He's, like, leather daddy. And my uh-huh. brother was, like, so dismissive. He was just like, oh, dude, who cares? Your dick just has a sore throat. No big deal.
Oh, man.
And I just remember being like,
oh,
what are
man.
You talking about? No big deal. I'm like George Costanza freaking
yeah,
out.
Yeah, yeah. Is it lupus? Is it lupus?
Exactly. I described the awful experience because, you know, when you work at these strip clubs, you don't have benefits. So you don't have health care.
Right,
they don't
right.
give you anything.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I had the city of San Francisco offers you, the city clinic. So I had to go to the city clinic, and there's like people from all walks of life there. You know, you have trannies, you have tranny prostitutes, it's like gangsters. You have like, nice Jewish boys like myself. it was just a horrible experience. And you just have that number, and you're waiting for it to get called so you can have your dick checked.
Oh, my God. Oh, what a horrible experience. That sounds terrible.
So when I was writing it, it's like I'm reliving some of this stuff, and I'm like, God, this was pretty insane.
Perhaps
I don't have to experience it again, but it's kind of funny to think about. And that's one of the things, too, is like when I worked there, I had 3 notebooks just full of just weird notes and stories. And I didn't do anything with those for a while until, it was a couple of years ago, and I took a look at them again when I moved down to L.A., and I was like, oh, shit, some of the stuff is kind of funny here. and then I basically just wrote out those stories.
Well, that's great, man. And it's turning out to be a fantastic book. Are you getting some good press for it and people liking it?
Yeah, it's been received pretty well. It's hard for to be an indie author. Like, the one thing that I didn't do is I didn't go the traditional route of pitching it to a literary agent and then going to like a big publishing house.
Right.
Because a friend of mine is an author in San Francisco. His name's Scott Sigler. He's a great guy. Actually, he has a really cool science fiction series that he self-published. And he's one that sort of pushed me into doing the self-publishing route, which has been very difficult.
I can imagine.
But it's difficult because you have to do all the stuff that a publishing company would do.
Right.
Yet 90% of my profits, whereas if a publishing company is doing it, I would get like 10%. But they take care of the editing of the book, the construction of the book, marketing of the book.
And distribution.
And distribution, which is a big thing. And so, it was for me, I had this built-in podcast following. So it's like a lot of people, were excited about the book and they bought the book from that. But yeah, it's pretty much just like grassroots sending out emails to like different podcasts, radio shows. But the book's been like really well received. People find it pretty funny.
Well, that's great.
Some people find it kind of nauseating.
Yeah. Well, it definitely starts out. It starts out with that story, Lexi, which I would urge every one of you to go to. You can get it on Amazon, correct?
That's the sample chapter on Amazon.
Oh, okay, so, okay.
You can read the entire story of Lexi and then decide whether or not you want to buy the book.
Oh, man. Well, and I will say that one is definitely a lot more graphic than the stories that follow it.
But Aaron, you haven't read the last story.
No, I haven't gotten to that yet. So maybe it's not, maybe it's not as graphic, but it's definitely like, you start in the second and third story, you start talking about, your childhood and how you, your first strip club experience and how you got into the whole mess, if you will.
Yeah. And I think from there, that's where it was loosely chronological. And then it's just like specific strip club experiences.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I end with, like, pretty graphic story that was probably one of the worst experiences of my life, I would say.
Oh, great. Well, I look forward to reading that, Dee. I definitely look forward to that.
Every time I hear, and that's a beautiful Led Zeppelin song, but it's ruined for the rest of my life now. It really is. I can't even listen to it anymore.
Well, hey, I wanted to ask you one more question before I let you go, because I know you need to get going here. One thing I've always wondered is, are all strippers working towards some sort of degree, or is that just flat out a lie?
I never really dated any strippers. I had sex with many strippers. But a lot of the girls that I end up like hooking up with or would hook up with on a regular basis were in college. Like one girl went to Berkeley. She
really?
Was pursuing a graduate degree. Another girl was like, actually, two girls went to Berkeley. One girl went to USF. One girl was in nursing school. I would say the vast majority, though, no.
No.
And
okay.
It also depends, too, on the club itself. Like, the Ruby Club a lot of the girls there had to be more responsible or they would be fired. Like, there was a really strict. You should have girls that were a bit more intelligent, a bit more reliable, a bit.
Yeah.
And they're still strippers. But but they did have their shit together. Or, you know, I mean, there are a lot of, like, single moms. That's a myth. That is true.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember the Ruby Club, they're a bit more strict because it's kind of a privilege. You're going to make a lot of money if you work there. So if you screwed up, you know, you'd lose out. But that the smaller clubs, like the lower end clubs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I ever met a girl there that was in college.
Right, right.
Definitely not. Especially the really ghetto clubs. Like, those ones are like, a lot of those girls could barely read.
I know. Well, it makes me feel better that there is actually, like, a good part of that industry, I guess. You know?
You know, the fact of the matter is, like, a lot of girls, you do make a lot of money, and you make a lot more money than you would, you know, waiting tables. So,
right, right.
This one girl I worked with that was at Berkeley, she was like, you know, I can work two nights at the Ruby Club. She's like, and I'll make, like, around $4,000. She's like, you know how many nights I've worked at, you know, at that cafe to make that much money? She's like, so for me, I only have to work three or four nights a month, and the rest of the time I spend studying.
Wow.
You know, and I bet you I mean, she's a doctor now or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell no one about her past.
Yeah. Well, hey, D, man, it has been absolute pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for getting in contact with the show, and I'm so glad that we could do this. And I find the book is just fascinating so far. So
Totally. Well, thanks for having the show, and yeah, people, you can go buy the book on Amazon.com. Just do a search for "Play Something Nancy." It's available in print and on the Kindle. It's also on Barnes and Noble and on the iTunes bookstore.
Wonderful.
As well.
Wonderful. And where can we check out, like, do you have, I think you just said that and I cut you off, a website, and where can we find Second Wrong?
Okay, so my personal website is dsimon.net. It's just a blog that I have, but there's links to, like, the store for the book and everything. There's also links there to my podcast, which is sickandwrongpodcast.com. And you can also do a search in iTunes just for Sick and Wrong, and you can check out some shows. We're like another weekly podcast, usually about an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And, also, a lot of the definitely for people that have a bit of a stronger stomach.
Well, that's good. Really. That's good to know. Good disclaimer.
All right, Aaron. Well, thanks a lot for having me on, man.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
All right. Take it easy.
All righty, buddy. All right, I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation with author, podcaster, D. Simon. I know I had a fantastic time talking with him, and even when we stopped recording, we actually just kept talking on the phone for another, like, 20 minutes. It was great. Great guy. So go and check his podcast out, the Sick and Wrong podcast. They do very well on iTunes. Speaking of iTunes, please, if you enjoy the show, if this is your first time listening, or if you're coming from the Sick and Wrong side of things, go check out our archives. And also, of course, the hell does that mean? Of course, go onto iTunes and subscribe to the show. Rate and review us, please. We're almost to 100 star ratings up there. There's a lot of you guys that listen to this show, and a lot of you guys get the show from iTunes. We know that because we can see the downloads on there. And a lot of you have yet to go and rate and review the show. So please do that. Please do that. Help us out. Do us a solid, will you, this holiday season. Also, a couple things to get out of the way. If you are new to the show, please go visit the website as well, www.air-raid.net. You can find all of our archived episodes with people like Bob Saget, Dana Gould, comedian Pete Holmes, Eddie Pepitone,
Oh, man. Just, I mean, the list just goes on, guys. Duncan Trussell, all these guys. Grand Archives, the band Pickwick, John Roderick, keeps going. Sean Nelson from Harvey Danger, The Dismemberment Plan, director Lynn Shelton. I could go on. It's all there at our archives page at www.air-raid.net. So go and check that out. And that's going to do it, guys. We're going to be back next week with comedian Hari Kondabolu. Did I say that right? Hari Kondabolu. I think it's pronounced Hari. So, we'll be talking with him. I look forward to that. So thanks for listening, guys. This is the song Leather by Eric Blood to play us out this week. Go check him out, Eric Blood. The album's called Touchscreens. Song is called Leather. Have a great week, everybody. Thanks for listening.